night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha illallah. Never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and thy name we start today's episode. So, dear listeners, welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. I am Asma at your service as the host. I have the pleasure to be here with two very dear guests, and welcome to the studio, brothers. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for having us.
Walaikum assalam. Yep, happy to be here.
Thank you very much. So, it's the ritual, and we're not going to break the ritual, so please introduce yourself very much briefly.
I'm Ali, and I'm a student in the holy city of Qom.
And I'm Sayyid Mustafa. I'm also a student here. I'm also studying psychology along with Islamic studies.
I wish you both luck and thank you for being here. Since we have talked about war and about Zionists recently, and if you're following us, previously we talked about the reasons of why Zionists are doing this and that and the extremist point of view that they have. Now, let's come to this point that why Muslims, because actually Palestine is the question of Muslim people. Why they did not solve it, and after all these years, still Palestinian people are suffering from the same issue. Why they, all the Muslim people, all the Arab people, let's say, they did not come together and solve this issue once and forever?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we have only, I believe, about 14 to 15 minutes to discuss it, which is probably not enough to discuss
exactly
about a 75-year history or 100-year-old history. But we'll try to sort of touch on some of the highlights of why this is the case. I think the first answer that comes to my mind, which is the most obvious, is that who has put these Arab leaders in their power positions, right? It's really important to see how a lot of these even Arab countries came into existence to begin with. Like, they didn't exist about 100 years ago. It was just the Ottoman Empire, right? So how do we have like Jordan, Bahrain, and all these other countries? How, where did they come about? They were carved up by the British after World War II, right? A very interesting story about this, I would highly recommend you guys go and look it up, is called Churchill's slip up, or Churchill's something like that. When he was carving up Jordan, he was drunk and his hand slipped. And that's why there's like a big zigzag in Jordan's like border. Okay. So when the British created these countries, of course, they created the environment for them to be able to control the policies that are also in place in a lot of these countries.
So they used them as their own, let's say, offspring to do whatever they want.
For their own benefits.
Yeah, for their own benefits.
Yeah, one last thing before I'll allow the brother to add his input is that a lot of the security, a lot of the security of the royal families is managed by British and American defense agents.
And of course, most of them have studied abroad, like in Britain or in America.
I don't think there's any... I studied abroad, okay? There isn't an issue in studying abroad. I think the issue is that...
No. You know what's the issue? The issue is that they would be under the effect.
Yeah, but I'm saying like the control is much more like serious in the sense that it's a security defense control, right? On a level of military security. So how can they go against their masters in that sense?
Like the brother mentioned that the answer to this would be in history. We need to go back in time. To get to the answer, we need to go further back in time.
Okay.
The roots of this problem that is arising, like, you know, the Palestine is a Muslim country. The Muslims being oppressed. Oh, if we talk about, you know, on the major scenario, it's an Arab country. So it is expected more and more Muslims or more Muslim countries to raise their voice and stand against terrorism. But this is not the case, as we see. So the roots to this problem, what I believe is the ideology that the most of the Arab countries have.
Which is?
And that is Wahhabism. What Wahhabism teaches us, again, like, this might be somewhat related to brother's point as well. He said that, you know, it is the British who got who created Wahhabism.
Right.
So the thing is, and even before that, you know, their rulers and the Abbasids and the Umayyads, their belief, answer to this is a root and their beliefs. Their beliefs was, you know, anyone can be a ruler, even if he's an oppressor. That's their belief, right? So now you look, the countries that are standing with Palestine and, you know, that are supporting the Palestinians and they're against Israel openly are what? It's Iran, and it's Iraq, it's Yemen, and it's Syria. Iran, it's a Shia country. We take our lessons from Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. So our imams have taught us that we need to stand against oppression.
Yeah.
Whereas it's not the case over there.
Although I would challenge you on one thing, though, is that a big part of their Arab countries' public is not Wahhabi, by the way, right? A lot of their public do come out in support of Palestine. It's just that, unfortunately, a lot of the governments will not allow that to turn into anything more than that.
That's
right?
The case. Right? That's the problem that we are facing. You know, most of the people that, you know, they might have good beliefs. So there's the same case with the rest of the people, even the non-Muslims. If you see that, you know, what's the situation in the world right now? Like, you see, like, there's so many people, millions and millions of people that are standing with Palestine. And even if you see that there was a voting for a ceasefire in the UN, and 120 countries voted for what? In support of Palestine. They supported ceasefire. It's just 14 countries that voted in favor of Israel.
Right.
And what are those 14 countries?
Yeah, I guess we're getting somewhere very nice. Well, right now we have to go for the break. So just keep your ideas, and then we'd be back to hear them. So, dear listeners of IRB English Radio, welcome back. This is Back to Reality. We're still talking about Palestine and why this Muslim community in different countries, in Arab countries, they do not stand up and do something for Palestine as their own issue, because we all are sharing the same religion and we have the same, mostly we're living in the same place. So we got somewhere that was so interesting to note, which you said that these countries, maybe the people in there, are for the benefits, for the release of these Palestinians from the brutalities of the Zionists. But then their leaders, their governments, do not want that because their own benefit is going to be in danger.
Exactly. Like, if as I mentioned before the break, if you look at the countries unbiased, like the countries that are mostly active in this situation are Iran and Lebanon.
Yeah.
And both of them are Shia countries.
And Yemen.
And Yemen and Iraq and Syria, they're also, they also have an, you know, active participation in this thing. Either the countries are Shia or they are influenced by a Shia country or a Shia leader.
Right.
That is Iran. So these things, again, we have the roots. Like, you know, it gets back to the teachings of Ahlul Bayt. We believe in a divine leadership, and we stand against oppression. Whereas the Wahhabism, in contrast, you know, in Wahhabism, anyone can be a ruler, and even if an oppressor comes and removes that ruler from the throne, he's your new ruler, and you have to obey him. That's what the beliefs in...
Which is so ridiculous.
That's what the Wahhabism believe.
Yeah.
So how can this lead such type of governments and such type of rulers to stand against oppression?
And I think a great example of that would be the fact that, you know, Yom Quds, the Day of Quds, which is normally a day where people come out in solidarity with Palestinians at the end of... It's the last Friday of Ramadan. That's a day that Imam Khomeini introduced, to the world. It's not a day that other Arab countries, for example, introduced to the world, right? Mm-hmm. And till this day, it's a huge...
And by the way, what was the idea behind that? Why do we have such a day in our calendar, specifically in the holy month of Ramadan?
It's to raise awareness about Palestine, right? That's one of the main ideas, is to raise awareness. Because at that time, back when Imam Khomeini brought this issue up, it was not such a hot issue. People had sort of given up on Palestine. Even like Palestinians had thought they've lost everything. The Israelis thought that they had won. So when Imam Khomeini and the revolution came here, that's what sort of broke that sort of perception and image. Mm-hmm. The amazing thing is that we will stand against oppression. It doesn't matter who the oppressed is. They don't have to be Shia. They don't have to be Muslim. If there's a human being that's being oppressed, we are there to stand against the oppressor.
Yeah. So we have that day in order not to forget Quds and not to forget Palestinians and how much they're suffering from those oppressors.
Yeah, I would say that, the answer to the question, why should a Shia leader or Shia country be more active and, be the flag bearer of this resistance? The answer to this would be because we are the followers of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. This is what Ahlul Bayt has taught us.
So we've been raised on those ideas and on those concepts that if there is a person who is being oppressed, no matter what color they are, no matter what language they talk, and no matter where they are living in, we have to stand up and we have to speak up. Like to think that we expect as human beings from all the people who are living in the Middle East, because, Palestine is close to us, so we cannot be so easy with the fact that some people are getting killed at the same moment that I'm living my life right in this country. So this is not an easy thing to cope up with.
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to the core of the topic, which was, about why are Arab countries not doing their sort of part in this, I would almost stop differentiating between Arab countries and other countries. Because for me, they're all the same. They're all under the same sort of Zionist controlled one world sort of government. They're being funded, their businesses, everything is connected to the West. And
they're just namely Muslim countries.
So money and power are talking in here.
Definitely. That's a huge part of this.
Yeah.
Right? It's a huge part of this. So many of these countries have bent over backwards, as we would say, because of money and power issues. Yeah. They're unwilling to let go of
power. And if there is any country who would speak up, then there would be sanctions.
Yes,
it can be anything. So it's just their personal interest that... gets them into any talks or not. There's just personal interest.
Yeah.
That's a very important point, by the way, that you just mentioned sanctions. Like Iran is under sanctions. One of the big reasons we're under sanctions here is because of our support of Palestine.
Exactly.
Right? We are paying a cost for it.
It's because not like that's a danger for the Zionists.
Exactly. So if Arab countries were to start supporting, they know that they will face...
They would have suffered from the same troubles that
we're
suffering.
Right. So they decided to make the deal with the devil and,
Yeah. So you sell your other world and buy this world, and though you know that this one is temporary, it's going to end, and finally the truth is going to be winning anyway. Because there'd be a green future for us, and we do believe in that. The situation is not going to be like this forever. There'd come a promised Imam, and he would save all the world.
Definitely.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
I would even say, even historically, the brother mentioned me. I would even go way back into history and say that...
Well, only the tyrants would change.
Right, yeah.
The brutal person just changes. Oppression would never cease to exist as long as Imam Mahdi is not there. So we do tend to believe that one day everything is just going to be solved and we all shall find peace eventually. So we got the answer, and the gist would be telling the truth is going to have some dangerous consequences that not all the people and all the nations have the courage to do that. So there are power, there are money in the middle of this story, and we cannot underestimate the power of them. So thank you for staying with us until another session. I leave you to God's never sleeping eyes, and wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Israel's complex and uncertain future.
Part 1.
Kibbutzim, hailed by many Israelis as paradisiacal havens, stand as enduring symbols of resilience and human ingenuity. These lands were originally owned by Palestinians, but now these kibbutzim have transformed into the hubs of industry and agriculture for the Israelis. Kibbutzim feature lush gardens, fertile fields, and modern amenities. A stroll through these paradisiacal spaces reveals a blend of fragrant flowers and joyful children, creating an atmosphere of peace and prosperity. Inhabitants enjoy a high standard of living with quality homes, excellent schools, and healthcare services. Meanwhile, just a few miles away lies the Gaza Strip, where a markedly contrasting reality unfolds. The people of Gaza have endured a protracted period of severe hardship, grappling with profound deprivation due to the constraints imposed upon them by Israel. Even the simple act of fishing along their shores has become an arduous endeavor, burdened by stringent restrictions enforced by Israelis. However, on Saturday, October 7th, the calm in Kibbutzim was shattered when Hamas fighters mounted a daring challenge to Israel's perceived military might, altering the world's perception of the situation. The skies, usually pristine, became cloaked in smoke as paragliders bearing these fighters swooped down. Simultaneously on the ground, a relentless wave of heavily armed fighters, many on motorcycles, followed bulldozers that brazenly breached the fortified fences separating Israel from Gaza. This wasn't all. The lightning-quick, multi-pronged ambush also included dozens of Hamas fighters on motorboats who descended upon Israeli beaches. They stormed into cities, catching Israeli soldiers off guard and leaving settlers in a state of shock. This was not the Iron Dome they had envisioned. Israel's Iron Dome serves as a shield against relentless rocket attacks, safeguarding settlers from groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. Equipped with advanced radar and tracking systems, it detects and intercepts incoming rockets, claiming to have a success rate of approximately 90%. During a recent visit by OpenAI CEO Sam Altman to Tel Aviv University, Israel made a deliberate effort to showcase its technological prowess, presenting innovations like the Iron Dome as a display of pride, even if it may not have been as groundbreaking as suggested. Israel has wielded the Iron Dome not only as a defense mechanism, but also as a diplomatic tool, projecting an image of security and deterrence on the global stage. Other nations, such as South Korea, have sought to develop similar missile systems. Saturday, October 7th, marked a pivotal moment in Israeli history as the Palestinian resistance group Hamas executed an extraordinary multifaceted attack. Employing a calculated campaign of deception, Hamas managed to catch Israel off guard with a devastating assault. Their forces, utilizing bulldozers, hand gliders, and motorbikes, confronted the formidable Israeli military. This Saturday assault represents the most significant breach in Israel since the Arab Army's 1973 conflict. It came after 2 years of careful planning by Hamas, marked by military secrecy and convincing Israel that they sought no confrontation. Israel acknowledges being taken by surprise by an attack timed to coincide with the Jewish Sabbath and a religious holiday. Major Nir Dinar, spokesperson for the Israeli military, admitted, "They surprised us and they came fast from many spots, both from the air and the ground and the sea." Israeli Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Herzliya Levy has also publicly acknowledged shortcomings related to the Hamas operation. Here's how the operation, named Al-Aqsa Flood, was executed. An initial barrage included two stages. In the first stage, more than 3,000 rockets rained down on various Israeli settlements within a mere 6 hours. These targeted barracks, outposts, and checkpoints, forcing Israeli soldiers to seek refuge. During the second stage, an additional 2,000 rockets were launched, primarily targeting the same objectives. The rockets streaked through the sky and began raining down on specific targets in Israel. After penetrating the Iron Dome, inflicting extensive damage and casualties, it instilled a profound sense of fear, prompting thousands of Israelis to urgently seek refuge. But this was merely a diversion, the prelude to a meticulously coordinated operation. As the resistance fighters, aided by first-person view drones and grenades, systematically seized dozens of observation towers held by the Israelis, their complex operation unfolded. In the next phase, over 25 barracks and outposts fell under their control, achieving all their objectives with impressive success. In this critical phase, they captured the Kerem Shalom military site, leading to the destruction of several Merkava tanks and the apprehension of their crews. Many of these tanks were from the site, and numerous seized trophies were transported back to Gaza. Simultaneously with paragliders, they managed to bypass the formidable Israeli military fortifications erected along the Gaza borders and launch assaults from unexpected directions. By neutralizing these fortifications, they paved the way for other fighters to strike Israeli outposts. This strategic approach allowed them to penetrate up to 25 miles deep into the occupied territories on the very first day of the operation. Video footage shared on social media captured the dramatic scene of Hamas fighters descending via paragliders near one of these so-called paradises named Re'im Kibbutz, located approximately 3.3 miles from the wall that demarcates the boundary between Gaza and southern occupied territories. As the next phase started, Hamas fighters executed a swift and highly precise operation, successfully capturing various camps and kibbutzim all at once. They advanced towards Kibbutz Be'eri, taking advantage of the early morning hours when many Israelis either sought shelter from the ongoing rocket attacks or were asleep. Other destinations included the Nahal Oz camp, where robust Israeli resistance was met, but eventually overcome, yielding significant trophies transported to Gaza. As they pushed toward Kafr Aza, the fighters encountered determined resistance. Capturing this location proved a formidable challenge, but they persevered, securing Kafr Aza and acquiring numerous trophies for transport to Gaza. Strategically crucial was the Erez crossing, a major entrance to Gaza. The wide expanse provided numerous trophies, and many Israeli officers lost their lives or were captured. With captured bulldozers, the fighters disrupted the walls and fences of the Gaza Strip at multiple locations, disorienting Israeli forces and impeding their strength and reaction times. As barriers were breached, the fighters started the next phase of the attack, simultaneously advancing into urban areas and capturing police stations. In the city of Sderot, they took control of the police outpost, inflicting heavy casualties on Israeli personnel. Ashkelon was another important target. The resistance fighters marched through its streets, their actions vividly documented in history. This marks the moment when a new element came into play, the speedboats.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a topic which is very interesting. A lot of people talk about it and ask about it. And that is, what are the rights that animals have over us? As you know, Islam is a complete religion. It's a religion which addresses a lot of different, you know, things. And it has rules for everything. One of the things that it speaks about is the rights that we have over one another, and also that rights of other things have over us. One of these is the rights that animals have over us. So the question we want to ask today is, what are these rights? What are some of these rights that animals have over us? Fortunately, we have many hadiths and which allude to the answer to this question. Let's look at some of these hadiths and see what we can understand from them regarding the rights that animals have over us. One time the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam saw a she-camel whose knees were tied up, carrying her load. He said, "Where is her owner? Tell him that he should prepare for the lawsuit tomorrow," meaning on the day of resurrection. And he said, "Verily Allah loves gentleness and he aids in implementing it. So when you ride a lead animal, dismount it at the right place. For if the land is barren and arid, then get away from it. And if the land is lush and fertile, then dismount the animal and allow it to rest and graze." Right, so in general, as a general rule, we've been advised to be clement and kind to animals and not overburden them with the tasks that they cannot perform. The Prophet said, "Mount the sound animals and look after them properly and do not treat them as chairs for your conversations in the streets." Meaning don't just sit there sitting on the mount of the horse and speak to one another on them without, you know, moving. "For many riding animals are better than their rider and are more remembering of Allah Blessed and Most High." In a very specific hadith in which the Prophet, he enumerates six rights that the animal has over its owner, the Prophet said, the animal has six rights over its owner. Once the owner has dismounted the animal, he should allow it to graze. This is the first one. He should give it access to water if they pass by it. This is the second right. He should not hit the animal except when it truly deserves it. This is the third right. He should not burden it with a load that it cannot bear. This is the fourth right. He should not overtask it with a journey that it cannot endure. This is the fifth right. And finally, the Prophet said, and he should not sit on it for lengthy periods of time. This is the seeks the right of the animal over its owner. And in another beautiful hadith, the Prophet said, "Do not hit animals on their faces, for verily they praise and glorify Allah." This is, one of the rights. Because as we know, everything, according to Islam, everything praises Allah and glorifies Him. One of these things is animals. They do so with their tongues and their faces, and therefore we shouldn't hit them on their faces. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the rights that animals have over us and over their owners in the light of the hadith and the Quran. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
But one of the questions that I want to try and answer in this topic about the youth especially and this guidance which I call a give-and-take relationship is that why do we find youth primarily, but even older people, distancing themselves from religion, if not completely leaving Islam altogether? Maybe praying now and then, maybe fasting Ramadan. The basics is the youth themselves are not taking the time to learn their own religion. Yes, I have said in the past, our communities need to provide services. The local scholars need to provide services. The parents need to be there to provide religious instruction, not necessarily cultural indoctrination and brainwashing. But at the same time, the youth also have a responsibility. Ashabul Kahf, they did what they had to do. They felt under threat. They left. The youth of today, they also have a responsibility. Just as they can go online and Google and look at YouTube videos to learn how to do anything and everything, they also have the ability to find the sound Islamic knowledge. Now, I'm not saying you just go to Google and type in a question or YouTube and you look at the first video or article and accept it, you know, carte blanche, no questions asked. No, you still need to do your due diligence and dig to make sure you're getting the right answers. But the thing being that if we don't seek out the guidance from the right sources, we'll look for that guidance anywhere, right? If you don't have halal food in your city, you'll go and eat haram because you want food and you'll get it wherever you can find it. And so we have a hadith which I want to share with us from our sixth imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salatu wassalam, where he's been quoted as saying, "There's no goodness in our companions," meaning in our Shia, "if they do not ponder deeply on religious issues." La khair, he says, there's no goodness. If you don't sit and think about your religion rather than being spoon-fed by Maulana or somebody, he says there's no goodness in you unless you sit and reflect on this religion you've been given. And he's talking to a man named Bashir. So he says, "Oh, Bashir, indeed, if a person from amongst those who claim to be our Shia, if he or she does not reflect on their religion and does not become acquainted with its rulings, which they need in their day-to-day life, then he will need other than our followers. They will go towards our opponents, the non-Shia, whether they be the non-Shias within Islam or the non-Muslims. And they will take him towards the path of deviation and misguidance, and he'll have no idea that he has diverted away. Now, alhamdulillah, I've never met any Shias who have left the Ahlul Bayt to go towards the Khulafa, right? I've never met anybody, alhamdulillah, in my years of traveling who have gone that path. But I have met those who are no longer identifying as Shias or as Muslims, as followers of Ahlul Bayt. There may be wavering. They're on the brink of kind of teetering between this side and that side. But as the sixth Imam says, if the Shias, if the youth themselves are not looking for answers in their own faith tradition, they'll go to another tradition. And the beauty of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, brothers and sisters, as you all very well know, they have given us answers for everything. The Ahlul Bayt give us the understanding of Tawheed, which no other Muslim can describe. Because our God doesn't have a foot or a shin. He doesn't come down on a donkey every Thursday night, as other Muslims have portrayed Allah to be. Right? Our Tawheed is the pure Tawheed. Our concept of prophethood is the perfect concept of prophethood. Our knowledge of religion and Islam and the world is perfect, not because of anything other than the fact that we follow 14 perfect individuals. The Prophet Fatima Zahra alayhi salam and the 12 Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salatu was-salam. And so when we have these 12, 13, 14 perfect personalities, our youth need to recognize that we go to their door and we ask them the questions and we get the answers. Now, yes, I will admit that we are severely lacking in English material. We have a lot out there, but we have a lot more that can be translated. Some of the translations are outright horrendous. But we're doing better than we did 30, 40 years ago, believe me. We have thousands of books available, and most of these are available online for free. Alislam.org is an amazing website. Duas.org for all of the duas with translation, an amazing website. We can do more, but we have a lot out there. We have great scholars who are offering a lot in English, and it is only increasing day by day. So two points I will leave us with is this guidance of the youth, this give and take relationship. At one level, as I've been saying, is that we have to give. The parents, the educators, the scholars of the community. The sixth Imam tells us that hasten to teach your children about the religion and the teachings before the deviants get to them. Now the Imam used the word of a specific deviant group at his time, the Murji, who had complete deviant beliefs that you could not question a person's iman or kufr. A person commits sins, this group believed that you cannot judge anybody. And they had other deviant beliefs, but the Imam was getting to a point that we have to be there at the beginning to guide our children before they get corrupted by the system and the society that they live in. So we have to give to the next generation. But then the youth also have to give from their side. And I'll end with one hadith where again the sixth Imam has been quoted as saying, "I don't like to see any of the youth from amongst you, amongst the Shia, except that you are in one of two different states. Either you are a scholar or you are a student. There's no option that we're just having fun. We're just playing video games. We're just, you know, playing Fortnite. We're just on Netflix. No, we're either a scholar of religion or we are a student on the path of salvation." He says, if you are a youth and you're not in one of these two states, then you have forsaken your youth. And if you have forsaken your youth, he says, then you have wasted the time of your youth, this short period that you have. And if you've wasted your youth and you've committed an act of dhulm, of transgression, of injustice to yourself. And if a youth commits an act of transgression, injustice, then I swear by the one who appointed Muhammad with the truth, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. He says that that youth will reside in hell. So we have a push and pull, a give and take relationship, brothers and sisters. The youth have to be given the instruction, the guidance, the support, the financial means if they need it. But they also have to do for themselves. They have to make it to be something they want. Just as they want to get to university, just as they want to get scholarships, just as they want to be the best in sports they play, then they have to also want to be the best believers. You and I cannot force it on our children. We can guide them, we can encourage them, we can show them the benefits, but we can't force Islam down their throat. We can't tie them up and drag them to the masjid. You have to come and sit. No, but if you bring them when they're young, they will want to come when they're older. And even if we do lose them, as we do for a couple of years, God willing, through our prayers and our continued activities, they will, God willing, come back to the path, because we recognize that the doors of Allah are always open, the doors of repentance are always open, and the doors of the center are always open for those who may leave, but God willing, they will come back one day.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
Midstream.
The Palestinian resistance Hamas is dealing very cautiously with the U.S.-Israeli entity proposals regarding what is referred to as the humanitarian ceasefire. So far, mediators had not reached an agreement accepted by all parties. The situation became clearer with the White House's announcement of a daily four-hour ceasefire, but then Zionist Israel quickly clarified that it does not imply a cessation of military operations. You see, the U.S. proposal for a temporary four-hour ceasefire daily was a response to the desires of the Zionist regime, which does not want a ceasefire that could be seen as an achievement for the resistance or have negative implications on the political situation within Zionist Israel, internationally, as well as on the military level. Whichever way you look at it, Washington aims for one goal, pushing the Palestinian resistance of northern Gaza to leave towards the south, in line with the basic plan to displace all the inhabitants of the Gaza Strip. Washington is basically telling Palestinians to leave or die. The resistance in the Gaza Strip has already made it clear that it will not compel anyone to stay or move from the north to the south. The resistance already views this proposal as additional U.S. support for the Zionist regime, since it does not provide a comprehensive cessation of military operations and prohibits the provision of genuine humanitarian support to the Gaza population. The Zionist regime is now requesting more time to achieve field accomplishments that would present the Israeli occupation army with an image of victory. They emphasize that the idea of displacing the population of the Gaza Strip to the south practically means clearing the way for the occupation army to launch a more intensive destructive operation in the entire north, absolving them of any accountability for the carnage under the pretext of the absence of civilians. The Israeli entity's rejection of the ceasefire is not only related to the military situation, but also to pressure the resistance forces to release a number of Israeli entity settler detainees without any reciprocation. This announced temporary ceasefire does not even align with the essence of the ongoing talks on multiple levels, including discussions in Cairo with a delegation of the Hamas leadership and meetings in Doha between the CIA Director William Burns, Mossad Chief David Bernia, and Qatari Prime Minister Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani. What the Americans haven't explicitly stated is that the one-sided ceasefires and potential agreements come as a result of U.S. pressure, primarily stemming from the failure of the Israeli occupation forces to achieve any significant battlefield accomplishments that could be used in negotiations. This suggests that the Israeli regime may soon be compelled to reassess its objectives to align with the outcome of the battles on the ground, where Zionist Israel is seriously suffering. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Tens of thousands of Palestinians fled northern Gaza last week as the World Health Organization warns of worrying trends and the risk of disease after weeks of Israeli occupation airstrikes. The increasing evacuation came as Israeli occupation forces closed in on the center of Gaza City, launching intense bombardment campaigns and claiming that the resistance of Hamas had lost control of the north of the Gaza Strip. To discuss this issue with us from Cairo is Mr. Paul Larudi, founder of the Free Palestine Movement and the Free Gaza Movement. It's always a pleasure having you on board with us, Mr. Paul. Now, the pace of Palestinian civilians fleeing the combat zone in northern Gaza has picked up as Zionist Israel's air and ground campaign there intensified under the patronage, obviously, of the United States of America, who supposedly announced a one-sided ceasefire aimed at practically just emptying north of Gaza from its residents. How likely is it that we will see that the Palestinian exodus happening again in other areas in Gaza, mainly in the center of Gaza and the south of Gaza?
Well, a lot depends. I mean, people do want to preserve their lives. And when the Israeli military is bombing everywhere, they'll try to seek safety where they can. We're not talking about the military here. We're talking about civilians who want to save their families and their children and this sort of thing. And can they be pushed, for example, into the Sinai? I imagine that with enough destruction, Israel would be able to do that if Egypt permits the border to open for that. But that there's no sign that that's going to happen. So they're really caught in a situation where they have to run away from wherever the danger is, but there's no place to go.
I hear that. And Paul, the idea of displacing the Palestinians of Gaza Strip in the south practically means basically just clearing the way for the Zionist occupation army to launch a more intensive destructive campaign in the entire north, preparing for the complete invasion of Gaza. However, the situation on the ground tells another story of extensive Israeli occupation army defeat. So what's the end game here then for the Zionists and the U.S. administration? When is it enough for them to say, that's it, we're done?
I don't know what it means to say, that's it, we're done, because I can't imagine that, let's face it, the resistance forces are extremely well prepared with the type of weapons that they're using and the strategy, and they've made a lot of the Zionist effort useless. Each time The Zionists think that they have bombed the resistance into oblivion. They send their soldiers in, and their soldiers get massacred because the resistance is prepared. So the only thing they can fall back on is to a complete genocide and ethnic cleansing. And that's what they're doing. They have no other strategy than to try to massacre thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps eventually even hundreds of thousands of people. Who knows? But they're not making much headway against the resistance.
Mm-hmm. Well, all of this suggests that maybe the Israeli regime will soon have to be compelled to reassess its objectives in Gaza to align at least with the outcomes of the results of the battlefield. But does that mean that a prisoner swap might be in the horizon? And if so, if that actually happens, if a ceasefire happens and the prisoner swap happens, what guarantees that Palestinians will have that after the swap, the Israeli entity will not just launch another ground invasion and another bombardment campaign against Gaza?
I think the prospect of a swap is a realistic one because obviously, the government, Netanyahu and his cronies, are failing on the battlefield, and they're highly criticized by the people themselves, the Zionist population, and this is a way of perhaps regaining some credibility that they're not totally ineffective. So that's a possibility. As far as using massive destruction against the population after such a swap, if it ever takes place, I think the possibilities of massive destruction are equally great with or without a swap. They have what they call the Hannibal Directive, where if they think it's in their interest, they will actually bombard the place where the hostages are and their own soldiers if they think that they can gain by doing so. Let's face it, they have no respect for Palestinian life, and how much more respect do they have for the lives of their own people? I don't see it. I think they're willing to sacrifice
people. They already did that. We had a lot of reports coming from the resistance of Hamas saying that a number of the Israeli settler detainees were killed because of the aerial bombardment campaign by the Zionist entity. But Paul, you are now the founder of Free Palestine Movement and the founder of Free Gaza Movement. What are the efforts that you are trying to do in support of the Palestinian people? And what kind of maybe moral support are you bringing on with you from the United States of America towards the Palestinian people?
Well, we feel we have with us very talented people in terms of doing resistance and doing exercise and publicizing. And we have journalists, we have human rights activists and so forth. They're talented, but we're at a loss right now to figure out exactly how much we can get done. There are restrictions, of course, by the government in Egypt. Access to Rafah is very limited. But what we can do and what we are doing is we're demonstrating what the world is saying. We have millions of demonstrators across the world crying out to save the Palestinians and to stop the genocide. And I think that if we can get some of this action on the scene here in Cairo and perhaps elsewhere, then this will help to dramatize the concerns of the people of the world, and this will be reflected hopefully in action by at least some governments,
Do you think that your government will have any sort of an attempt to hear you out, to hear what the American public wants to say about this?
At a certain point, they have to. The demonstrations in the U.S. Are the biggest since the Iraq War. And it's really dramatic. The Palestinians have not always had very much success in the United States, but they are having it now. And this is very interesting. This is quite a turn. And especially the young people. It's young people who are turning out on the streets. So we're at a point where anything can happen. It's a very fluid situation. Mm-hmm. And the more we can get our voice and action in front of the people and the government, the more chance we have of making some sort of progress and headway. So that's we're trying everything.
Good luck with what you're doing, Paula Rudy, founder of the Free Palestine Movement and the Free Gaza Movement. Thank you for joining us to discuss this very, very pressing issue currently going on in Palestine. Thanks a million. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned because next we are going to talk about the Arab Islamic Summit in Riyadh.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The concluding statement of the Arab Islamic Summit held in Riyadh on Saturday called for lifting the siege on Gaza and ensuring the immediate entry of Arab, Islamic, and international humanitarian convoys, including food, medicine, and fuel into the sector. I'm sorry I'm not too excited about that result, but here are more details in this following report.
A disagreement occurred among the foreign ministers of Arab countries during their meeting on Thursday, November 9, in preparation for the Arab summit that was supposed to take place separately from the Islamic summit on Saturday in Riyadh. Just hours before the scheduled summit, Saudi Arabia announced on Friday evening the merging of the two summits, originally planned to host extraordinary meetings of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Arab League on Saturday and Sunday. However, the Arab foreign ministers who convened on Thursday for summit preparation were divided. Some countries, led by Algeria, called for cutting all diplomatic ties with Zionist Israel. The delegates added that a group of Arab countries that had established diplomatic relations with the Israeli entity opposed this move, emphasizing the need to keep channels open with the Israeli regime. Meanwhile, in the concluding statement on Saturday evening, the Emergency Arab Islamic Summit called for a halt to the war in Gaza, rejecting the Israeli entity's justification for its actions against Palestinians as self-defense. The summit condemned Israeli entity aggression on the Gaza Strip and the heinous, savage, and inhumane war crimes committed by the colonial occupation government. The statement also called for lifting the blockade on Gaza, allowing the entry of Arab, Islamic, and international humanitarian aid convoys into the territory and halting the export of weapons and ammunition to the Israeli entity. Among the prominent participants were Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, Jordan's King Abdullah II, Qatari Emir Tamim bin Hamad al-Thani, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi, and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi emphasized that Gaza is witnessing the worst crimes committed in history, which reflects a collapse of ethics and humanity. President Raisi reiterated that the Israeli entity violates international laws in the Gaza Strip and a decisive historical decision regarding what is happening in Palestinian territories is what Palestine needs now. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad stated that Arabs and Muslims today face unprecedented historical responsibilities because Gaza is not the issue. Rather, all of Palestine is the issue. President Assad declared that any plan undertaken in this Arab summit is meaningless unless the summit has effective tools of pressure against Zionist Israel. Although such important statements were made, however, over approximately 70 years, 62 Arab summits have been convened, with 14 of them labeled as emergency summits, including the latest held to address the Gaza Strip genocide. Contrary to the expectation that an emergency summit would address immediate crises, the term is used here 36 days after the aggression against Gaza began, raising questions about the urgency of the response with a huge gap evident between the rhetoric coming from normalizing Arab and Islamic states and their actions in support of Palestine.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashabi, political analyst and lawyer, expert in human rights, and supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which is published weekly with the Lebanese daily newspaper Al-Akhbar. Thanks a million, Dr. Nashabi, for being with us this morning. Now, contrary to the expectation that an emergency summit would address immediate crises, Riyadh's Emergency Arab and Islamic Summit was